It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Last year marked the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and other concentration camps, and the end of the war that produced the most astronomical body count in history. The Nuremberg trials set to even the scales and send a message that perpetrators of an attempted genocide would not go unpunished. Yet, as the decades passed, many of those looking to root out the guilty have died without a completed pursuit. In his book, The Nazi Hunters, former Newsweek foreign correspondent Andrew Nagorski tells the story of a small group of men and women who would not let the pursuit of Nazi war criminals rest. He writes about the hunters, the hunted, and the flickering embers of a pursuit that is about to end as a generation's greatest crime will have no more eyewitnesses. And we welcome Andrew Nagorski to the program. Andrew, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
94-year-old Reinhold Hanning is on trial in Germany, accused of being an accessory to the murder of 170,000 people. Hanning, prosecutors claim, was a guard at Auschwitz. Could this be the last of these type of trials?
It's one of the last. There are probably at least two or three other cases which are still working their way through the courts, are working their way to the indictment stage and then to an actual trial. So it's more than 70 years after the war. Of course, we're dealing with inevitably the last of these cases. If someone was an Auschwitz guard in his early 20s at the end of the war, he's now exactly the age of Reinhold Hanning.
For Reinhold Hanning to be on trial, Germany had to change the law for such prosecutions and did so not too long ago. What prompted this change?
Well, it's been a long battle ever since the Nuremberg and Dachau trials were conducted by the U.S. Army in Dachau for various concentration camp people. There have been a sort of division of an idea of who do you really prosecute and on what grounds. There were a German law usually held that you had to prove that someone was guilty of a specific act of murder, torture, so forth. There was treated as if it was just an ordinary criminal case of murder, and it just happened to involve millions of murders. So you had to prove each case. Now, if you were an inmate in a concentration camp, the last thing you wanted to do was stare at your captors and the people who were tormenting you and had your life in the balance. So as one investigator said, they tended to you look down at their shoes rather than their faces. So it was often, unless you were a notorious concentration camp guard, it was hard to identify you from the surviving witnesses. But then there was another school of thought, and that was propagated by some of the prosecutors, and including a very famous German-Jewish prosecutor, Fritz Bauer, in the 50s and 60s, and that is that if you were a part of that killing machine, you were a guard in Auschwitz and you knew what the purpose of Auschwitz was, or any other camp, or if you were one of these special forces that were sent out on the Eastern Front just to mow down Jews, gypsies, and anybody else who was deemed an enemy, then you, by definition, no matter what you specifically did, whether you could identify your victim, whether anybody could identify your specific victims, you were guilty. And on that basis, they tried someone called John Demjanjuk, a former concentration camp guard, and convicted him. And these last trials are made it much easier to bring people like this into court.
We're talking with Andrew Nagorski. He's a journalist and author of the book, The Nazi Hunters. After World War II and after the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi machine was held on trial at Nuremberg to try to bring an accountability to these crimes. But after Nuremberg, was there an effort to put those crimes in the past?
Very quickly, things changed. There were the Nuremberg trials, the Dachau trials. There were other trials in other parts of Europe, particularly in places like Poland, where the commandant of Auschwitz and other key perpetrators were tried and usually hanged. But then the Cold War sets in very quickly, the rivalry between the Soviet Union and the United States and its allies. And both sides quickly lose interest in the trials. Because they're very unpopular in Germany, but everybody wants democratic Germany as its ally. They're also, both sides are competing to get German rocket scientists, intelligence officers, you know, for the Cold War. And for instance, when I was researching my book, I found a man who had been in charge of the first CIA post in Berlin after the war. He happened to be a German Jewish. He was from a German Jewish family. He'd left Germany in the 30s as a child to go to school in England, then ended up in the United States, enlisted in the U.S. Army, was in the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA, and then he runs a CIA base in Berlin. And he said, none of us, not even me, coming from a German Jewish family, were thinking about the last war. We were thinking about the next war. And so we were totally preoccupied with our task. And we tend to forget how large the threat of the Soviet Union loomed in terms of national security concerns, and people were ready to move on. And that's why I think the story of the people I call the Nazi hunters is so extraordinary, because these were the people who insisted you can't just move on, you can't forget crimes of this magnitude, and they kept pushing to keep this issue open.
When we think about the hunt for Nazis in hiding, the Adolf Eichmann case comes to mind, and the Israeli Mossad found him in Buenos Aires and took him back for trial. But you point out in the book that the pursuit of Eichmann was the exception of the work that had been done to identify and try these war criminals. It was the exception instead of the rule.
Absolutely. It was one of the great, there are a lot of myths surrounding Nazi hunters, and particularly about Israel's role. The perception is that the Israelis, especially the Mossad, was out there hunting Nazis all over the world. Well, when I went to Israel to interview people for this book, I found a man by the name of Rafi Eitan, who was then a young Mossad agent and became the head of the field unit that actually physically seized Adolf Eichmann. He's still alive, well into his 80s, but a very vigorous man. And so I went to get his story. And one of the things he told me almost in passing was, by the way, in 1953, 7 years before the Eichmann kidnapping, I set foot in Germany for the first time. I was in Frankfurt, and immediately I'm thinking, oh, he must have been there to track down Nazis. He says, no, it had nothing to do with that. At that time, Israel was just had come into existence 5 years before, and we had this influx of Eastern European Jews from the Soviet Union, from Poland, Hungary, other places, and we knew that some of them had been recruited by the KGB or other Soviet bloc intelligence agencies, and that what they would report back from Israel would go straight back to Moscow and then would go straight to the Arab side. So I didn't have time to think about Nazis then, he was saying. And so while the U.S. was preoccupied with the Cold War, Israel was preoccupied with just its survival. And it wasn't until they got a tip later in the 50s that Ben-Gurion, who was the prime minister then, felt they should act on it, because he felt that not only the outside world was already forgetting what the Holocaust was all about or downplaying it, but in Israel itself there were problems, because the younger generation simply did not understand what was happening and was somewhat embarrassed, ashamed by this notion that somehow people had gone to their deaths meekly and didn't understand the mechanism that the Nazis used to fool people as long as possible. And they didn't understand that in some cases people tried to resist when there was an opportunity to do so.
Well, some of these Nazi hunters, like Rafi Eitan, came to the role through their operations with a government, and in his case as a Mossad agent. But others seem to have been directed towards this mission. And one of the most fascinating, I guess, two characters that you write about in this book, the Nazi hunters, are the Klarsfelds, the
Yes.
couple that captured or led to the capture and trial of Klaus Barbie.
Yes, I mean, the Klarsfelds are a fascinating couple. First of all, the assumption is usually most of the Nazi hunters were Jewish. Well, some were Holocaust survivors, of course, Steven Wiesenthal, the most famous among them. But the Klarsfelds are a totally different story. Beate Klarsfeld is German. She was born before the war. She grew up in Berlin. Her father was in the Wehrmacht, the German army. Her parents never talked much about the war, certainly never talked about the Holocaust. And at age 20, she goes off to Paris to be an au pair, and she meets Serge Klarsfeld, whose father, where he was from a Romanian Jewish family that had been living in France. Serge had been deported to Auschwitz and died there. And suddenly she begins to learn this whole history that had been overlooked and not been talked about. And she becomes, at first, even more than he did, this fervent Nazi hunter. And she is so outraged by the silence of this and by the fact that, for instance, in West Germany, there were a lot of former Nazis in positions of real responsibility, that she starts looking for ways not just to publicize that, but how to dramatize that. And her most famous incident was that she actually, when for a brief time in the mid-60s, there was a chancellor in Germany by the name of Kiesinger, who had been a Nazi and who had a significant position where he had to espouse these Nazi policies. She actually got herself a press pass to a party convention, got on stage, allegedly just walking by, and then slapped him and shouted, "Nazi, Nazi." And this was 1968, you know, the year when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. She could have been killed. And she spent spent a little time in prison, but it was so much bad publicity that she was released. And then she and her husband, Serge, really went after particularly Nazis, Germans who had been stationed in France and who were responsible for the murder and deportation of Jews from France. And Klaus Barbie had been the Gestapo chief in Lyon, and they tracked him eventually to Bolivia, and they mounted a huge campaign to get him out with various protests in Bolivia, in France, eventually succeeding in getting the French to bring him to France for trial. And he spent his remaining years in jail.
It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. If you're just joining us, we're talking this hour with journalist and author Andrew Nagorski. His book, The Nazi Hunters, is an examination of those who spent decades rooting out Nazis who fled across the globe after World War II to hold them accountable for the crimes that happened at concentration camps. So one of the most famous figures in the field of Nazi hunting would be Simon Wiesenthal. He is, of course, the founder of the Wiesenthal Center, which continues to do this sort of work today. And he died in 2005, I believe. But before that, yeah, you had an opportunity to interview him several times. He's a very controversial figure, even amongst those who conduct this sort of work. What do people criticize Wiesenthal for doing or not doing?
Yes, he was a very controversial figure. I got to know him well on and off. We met many times. First of all, I'll start with what everybody, even his critics, will agree on. In that period, in the early period of the Cold War, in the 50s and early 60s, when so many people just wanted to forget this issue, Wiesenthal was one of those people, probably the most prominent person, to keep pushing for accountability, for putting Nazis on trial. Now, you have to remember there are two kinds of Nazi hunters. There are official sort of government prosecutors, investigators to have the actual power to do those things. And then you have people most prominently like Wiesenthal, who on their own are pushing, but they are more like people who can try to gather evidence, if they're lucky, actually find people and tip off governments about them, or simply to publicize these cases. And so Wiesenthal was very good at publicity, and a lot of people assume that when I say I'm writing about Nazi hunters, I'm writing about sort of good guys versus bad guys. It's not that simple. I mean, if the Nazi hunters were a small group, very determined individuals, but they had huge rivalries and ambitions, and a lot of people felt at times that Wiesenthal was claiming too much credit for certain things. For instance, in the capture of Eichmann, there were reports at first, since the Mossad could not say who did it, how they got their leads, many people assumed Wiesenthal had been the key figure in giving the tip that allowed the Mossad to do this. Wiesenthal had been trying to trace Eichmann and had some information earlier, The Mossad claimed, the Mossad chief, Isser Harel, believed that it wasn't as valuable as he had portrayed, although there are disagreements on that. But the key tip actually came from somebody completely different, Fritz Bauer, who was this German-Jewish prosecutor after the war, who learned about his presence in 1957. So you had these sorts of conflicts. You also had conflicts between Wiesenthal and a group like the World Jewish Congress, which is a U.S.-based, despite its name, about how aggressively to go at someone like Kurt Waldheim, the former UN Secretary General, when he ran for the Austrian presidency in 1986. And it was discovered that he had covered up a large part of his past in the German army. He admitted to serving on the Eastern Front, but hadn't talked about his role in the Balkans, where there are huge war crimes were committed, although there were never direct evidence of his personal involvement in those war crimes. So these were disputes that went on and on. But again, Wiesenthal, I think let me give you one example of the kind of thing I think Wiesenthal was extraordinary for doing. Not so much for putting people in prison. And by the way, that's not the whole object of these kinds of trials. The big part of the role of the Nazi hunters and the trials was to educate the public about what had happened and to get rid of some of the misconceptions. And in Austria in the late 50s, for instance, there were a lot of Holocaust deniers, a lot of people who protested. There was some protest in his town, in his hometown of Linz, when there was a staging of the Diary of Anne Frank. And Wiesenthal was alarmed by this because he saw a lot of teenagers were susceptible to former Nazis' propaganda that, oh, maybe Anne Frank didn't exist at all, that this was her diary might be a hoax. And he determined to try to find the SS officer who had actually arrested the Frank family, because people did not believe the father, the only survivor of the family, about the whole story. And after many years, he tracked down this SS officer, who, by the way, was still serving in the Vienna police force. And this SS officer freely admitted that he had arrested Anne Frank and her family because he didn't see anything wrong with it. He said, that was my duty, that was what I did. And Wiesenthal never got anyone to prosecute this guy. But the fact that this SS officer admitted it publicly because of Wiesenthal's actions, it put to rest any notion that the Anne Frank story was a hoax. And we know generation of young people have really learned about the Holocaust from Anne Frank's powerful diary.
Well, as you say, the process of bringing these perpetrators to trial or to at least face the public presents not just an opportunity to bring justice or even vengeance to those who were the victims, but what it does overall is it provides an opportunity for testimony, for legal testimony, and this then brings documentation because, of course, almost all war crimes happen in an environment of sort of chaos and to a degree, an environment of secrecy.
Yes, and that role of testimony is critical, and people understood that from the beginning. For instance, one of the people I write about early in the book who's largely forgotten was the Polish investigating judge who conducted the trials of people like Rudolf Hess, the longest-serving commandant of Auschwitz. Now, Poland at that point had been taken over by a Soviet-type regime, and he didn't need to have a lot of testimony to have this guy hanged. But Jan Sen, who himself was actually from a Polish family of German descent, decided he really wanted to get the full story of this unbelievable guy who ran Auschwitz and who would boast about the so-called improvements in Auschwitz and couldn't understand why anyone felt he had done something wrong. And so he got him to, he treated him in very polite fashion, coaxed him into writing every day his memoirs, basically what became his memoirs, and the testimony he provides of how he developed Auschwitz and how he behaved and is a fascinating look into, you know, really the depths of evil, if you want to call it. You know, here's a man who was herding mothers and children into the gas chambers during the day and talking about doing that, and then bemoaning the fact that he didn't have enough time to play with his own children in the evening because he was so overworked. These sorts of testimonies are something that will stand the test of time, because part of our fascination, I think, with the whole era is not just about what's the record, how many were killed, but what is the psychology, how is this possible? And each one of these trials, as you say, of each having witnesses, having documents, having film footage, for instance, of the liberation of the concentration camps, that is a huge, huge contribution to our generations and future generations. And that's why these last trials are still very important, even if they are of people who at the time were sort of at the bottom of that chain of death.
Andrew Nagorski has written about the work of tracking Nazis over the decades since World War II in his book, The Nazi Hunters, and he has been joining us this hour. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Steve.
It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.